So we expect that in the near future, experiments can detect these transit events in great numbers. And then we will also be detect these events out to larger and larger distances. So that's why we may wonder whether or not we need to consider the scenario that when these transit bursts travel from the source all the way to the Earth, they will pass near some mass clumps in our universe and get gravitationally lensed. So in this talk, I will discuss a few aspects of the possible impacts of gravitational lensing on these transient events. So in the first part of my talk, I will be talking about the effects on gravitational waves. So this is some recent collaboration with the colleagues at the Institute, Chris Sigerson and Tejaswi Manumadev. So before I discuss how gravitational waves can be lensed, let's just briefly review how electromagnetic waves can be gravitational lensed. I will use this sketch. So we have a source at some distance away, and then there's a lens located in between somewhere near the line of sight, and there's an observer. So we know that when the electromagnetic waves travels just next to the lens, it will be gravitationally deflected. So it will follow not a straight trajectory, but a curved one. Under special situations, you might have more than one different trajectories that reach from the same source to the observer. In that case, a single source can appear as multiple images. And this is what we usually call the strong lensing regime. So there will be a few important observables, generally speaking, for strong gravitational lensing. One is that these multiple images will be separated. If you have the resolution to measure the angular position, then the difference in their angular position is an important observable. The second effect is that not only the trajectory is being deflected, but also the light beam is being focused or defocused. So that changed the total flux coming from each of the sources, each of the images. And this is magnification, which is a second important observable. Strictly speaking, the focusing effect will not be isotropic. So in addition to magnification, we also have called the shear. But in this talk, I will be mainly focusing on magnification rather than shear. And finally, another important observable is that the trajectory, if you follow the trajectory corresponding to different images, it has different geometrical length. In addition, the gravitational potential near the massive lens will also change the time of arrival. So when you sum the two contributions, you find that the time of arrival for different images are different, and then you want to measure that time delay. Finally, an important point is that the frequency of the wave will not be changed by gravitational lensing. So lensing of electromagnetic waves has been a very important phenomenon in astronomy. So here I just give you a few common examples. So here on the top left, this is a background galaxy sitting almost behind a foreground galaxy, right behind it. So you get its image is distorted into the so-called Einstein ring. And in the second picture, there's a background quasar that is strongly lensed by a foreground galaxy. So you end up having four images, A, B, C, D. And then in the lower panel, we talk about we have a much more massive gravitational lens, this time a galaxy cluster. So you can see that the images from background galaxies are distorted, and also they are magnified. So here, this is a slightly different source. This is a here. This is a supernova. That is multiply imaged by a foreground galaxy. So in this case, you expect different magnifications for different images. You also expect different time of arrival. So it could be that some images might not have reached us by now. And it could also be that some images have had appeared in the past, and then we actually have missed it. And then finally, in this picture, it is about a background star being lensed by something in a foreground, a very dense star cluster. So this is usually called a microlensing. In this case, we will not be able to resolve the multiple images of the source, but still, because of the magnification effect, we can notice the variation in the brightness of the background star. So we will detect a typical light curve. Okay, so much for this traditional example of gravitational lensing, very recently we become available a new type of observational probe becomes available to us, which is gravitational waves, mainly from merging binary black holes. So I think there's no need for me to repeat the significance of LIGO's recent discovery, but I just comment that even the first event is a bit of a surprise, because previously people were expecting a large fraction of the events should come from merging neutron stars, but this time the first event is a pair of black holes, which you normally don't see using any other observational method. And also the mass of these black holes of the two black holes are 30 solar masses, which is pretty large. Some people have a hard time understanding how we can get such massive black hole binaries in the standard story of stellar evolution. But even this event is not going to be the only event in the future. We have the full potential to detect a lot more such events, and then from higher and higher redshift. So here I'm plotting the sensitivity curve for a bunch of different ground-based gravitational wave detectors. So let me just remind that even this orange curve, which stands for advanced LIGO, is not yet the sensitivity we have now. There's still a room of a factor of three improvement from the current LIGO sensitivity to its fully designed sensitivity. And then then there's possible technological improvement we can implement to furthermore improve the sensitivity. So that corresponds to the dashed line, and that can improve by further by a factor of few. And then I also overplot the proposed this capability of this Einstein telescope, which is going to be an underground design. So you see that in terms of the string amplitude across most frequencies, it is another factor of few improvement. And most importantly, the underground design might be able to probe below into the very low frequency regime. And that is really helpful for us to detect very massive black hole mergers. So it will be true that these gravitational waves can be gravitationally lensed in almost the same way as electromagnetic waves, as long as we are in the so-called geometrical optics regime. That means the wavelength of the gravitational wave is much longer than the characteristic size of the deflector. Then the problem reduces to just finding the trajectory, the curve, the trajectory of the wave. So then the only major difference is that for gravitational wave, the observable is the string amplitude rather than the energy flux. So that will be magnified by square root of the usual magnification factor mu here. And again, the observed frequency of the waveform will not be changed. In the case of strong lensing, we will have multiple images. This time, rather, I would call it multiple bursts. If these multiple bursts are close enough in the time domain, we will be able to see double peaked events or triple peaked events and so on. But for a lens galaxy, this time delay is typically very long. So in this case, we would rather discover just two independent events.
Can you give us a sense for the probability that a random black hole merger would be gravitational?
So I will talk about it right in the next. Yeah. So it is a matter of chance that a very massive deflector happens to be aligned with the source binary. So statistically, you can using the lensing probability distribution function to categorize the chance how often this happens. So this is a probability distribution as a function of the magnification factor mu. So because we have to conserve the total solid angle, this PDF in general has the property that the mean magnification should be one. So that means in addition to a magnified part, which means mu larger than one, we would also have a demagnified part, which is mu less than one. But then you see that the shape of the distribution is highly asymmetric. There's a very strong lensing tail corresponding to very high magnification factor, and that behaves like a particular power law. So these curves can be numerically measured by ray tracing through n-body simulations. So it turns out that this strong lensing probability is dominated by lenses of the size of galaxies. We have larger lenses such as galaxy clusters or smaller lenses such as dwarf galaxy.
So how about the stars? Have you included that?
That's the next point.
So
it turns out that galaxies will dominate this lensing probability. And then it's true that because the gravitational wave source is pretty compact, so they are also subject to very small lenses such as stars. But it turns out that because the gravitational wavelength is longer than the Schwarzschild radius of a typical star, in this case we are deep in the diffractive regime. That means in this case we don't really have high magnification. So the conclusion is actually that stellar lenses are not so important for the. It turns out it's not the, so normally you would think it's the Einstein radius that needs to be compared, and that is very large. But actually if you work out the diffractive integral, it is rather the Schwarzschild radius that is to be compared. The reason is because basically you're saying you want to compare the time delay between different points on the lens plane, and if that time delay is less than one wave cycle, then you can constructively add. But then this time delay is of order the Schwarzschild crossing time instead of the physical size of the star. So the fact that the star is fairly compact means that you can assume it's a point lens and use the Schwarzschild lens model, but still it's in the diffractive regime.
Another issue is that right now all the redshifts are well below one.
That is true. So that is also I'm going to discuss this aspect.
So I mean, the wavelength of the gravitational waves, I'm not sure what it is, but it should be comparable to the Schwarzschild edges. It's maybe a factor of 10 different. So what is the?
It will be always larger because so when I say the typical Schwarzschild radius of the star, I'm thinking of like let's say one solar mass,
yeah.
And then for gravitational waves because basically right before the merge. It's like you are these binaries are moving near the speed of light, so that the wavelength that corresponds to the highest frequency, that wavelength will be like the basically like the separation between the two stars if they are moving at the speed of light. But then that has to be larger than the Schwarzschild radius of the star.
Well, I'm saying this could be different by a factor of 10 or so. So the question is how big a separation you get from being in a diffraction. It's not very deep. It's
Yeah, so in principle, if you look at the highest possible frequency, let's say a kilohertz from neutron star, but that's for neutron stars, a kilohertz, then it's within, it's roughly a factor of 10. So there will be some residual effects, but it's not very big. So there was previous study on the diffractive regime. So basically, I'm just saying for this magnification PDF, this strongly lensed tail, you don't have to worry about the stellar the stellar population because here you need a very high magnification factor, which you don't get in the diffractive regime. So. What's good about being strongly lensed? The obvious reason is that that allows you to see mergers at much larger distances. So here I'm plotting the redshift reach as a function of the binary black hole mass for different detector sensitivity. So I'm assuming you need signal to noise larger than 8 to detect. And then the red curve is the current LIGO sensitivity. The blue curve is the design sensitivity. And then this green curve corresponds to if you apply the technology improvement of the laser and the mirror, what you can possibly achieve with a detector on the ground on the surface of the ground. So you see that in this best case, you can just barely detect up to redshift of 1 or 2, and then with design, you can just detect up to 1. And not for the low masses. And then this is the Einstein telescope. It's really good. It can detect a very high redshift. But then if we apply a magnification factor, let's say 3 or 10, that corresponds to these dashed curves and dotted curves, then you see that the signal to noise would just multiply by a factor of mu. So you will be allowed to have access, even for the current LIGO, if it's magnified by a factor of 10, then you can go up to redshift 1. That's very significant, the effect of magnification.
The strain is inverse proportional to the distance.
Oh, sorry, I didn't hear very well.
The strain.
H plus. Yes.
It's inverse proportional to the distance source.
Yes, it's
so
it's.
Therefore, you expect the tensor strain is 10 to the power minus 21. So if you increase the distance significantly,
No, I'm just saying, for a given source, if it's being magnified, then normally we would not be able to detect it. But when it's magnified, we can detect it. So basically, like this, if you're sitting here, then you are beyond the usual sensitivity. But if it's magnified, you will be able to see it.
How do you expect this magnification to happen?
How do I expect?
Such a large increase of magnitude.
So it will happen with so most of the events will not be magnified, and then there's a small fraction that will be. So I will discuss it. But then there's when you have magnification, we realize that there's a degeneracy when you try to determine the parameters of the source. It has something to do with the scale invariance of the gravitational dynamics. So say let's consider the merging process of two black holes, each with 10 solar mass. Now we want to scale the problem up. Let's talk about 20 solar mass black holes. In this case, if you increase the distance between these two black holes by a factor of 2, and also the Schwarzschild radius increases by a factor of 2, then the dynamics is actually can be actually scaled. This is because we can always work in the geometrical units so that length and time will be expressed through multiples of Schwarzschild radius and Schwarzschild crossing time. That just means the dynamics will be unchanged if we simultaneously scale the mass of the system and then scale the distance and time of the system. So we can also think of the problem in this way. So if we want to simulate two black holes numerically, then we don't have to do two separate simulations for 10 solar mass black holes and 20 solar mass black holes. We just need to simulate, we just need to do one simulation. And this property will be exact for black holes in the fully nonlinear regime. It will be not true for stars, because for stars we have some preferred mass scale for them. So that is not a problem, but it is a problem for black holes.
So how is it that the LIGO can code their redshift before there? It sounds like you're saying they could just put the event at a different redshift to rescale the time and rescale it.
Good question. So that's the next slide. So basically, you can measure two things with the observed waveform. You can measure the typical scale in the vertical direction, that's the amplitude, and you can measure the typical scale in the time direction. And then the first one gives you a measurement of basically the observed string amplitude that is inversely proportional to the luminosity distance. But then if this event is being magnified, it will be multiplied by square root of mu. And then the second observable will constrain a combination of the mass scale and the redshift. And then the detailed shape of the waveform will just constrain the dimensionless parameters of the system, such as mass ratio and spin parameter. So then you realize that these two constraints, they have you got two constraints, but you have three unknown parameters. So you cannot without additional information, you cannot simultaneously pin down all three of them. So let's consider a few scenarios. Say you ignore the possibility of lensing magnification, and in this case, we can distinguish between the case you have electromagnetic counterparts so that you can measure redshift separately, or if you can't. So in the former case, you will be independently measure mass, redshift, and luminosity distance. That allows you to test the cosmology using standard siren. But even if you don't have independent measurement of the redshift, you can at least assume a fiducial cosmology that relates luminosity distance and the redshift, so you will still be able to figure out the mass and redshift of the source. But now, if you allow the possibility that you can have a magnification, then this time, This time, even if you have an independent redshift measurement, so this time you require an independent redshift measurement to simultaneously pin down mass, redshift, and the magnification factor. But without an independent redshift measurement, you have three unknowns and just two constraints. So you cannot pin down all three of them. So that is a degeneracy. That means, suppose you are ignorant about the magnification factor mu, then you just then you will still fit the observed waveform using some inferred mass scale m twiddle and some inferred source redshift z twiddle, and these will be different from the physical mass scale m and the physical redshift z. So note that this degeneracy exists even if you assume a given fiducial cosmology. So then on this slide, I will just show you how this give you a rough idea how this degeneracy is. So this is a plot: the inferred redshift versus the observed versus the true redshift. And then the red curves are contours of magnification factor. And then the blue dashed curves are contours of the ratio between the inferred mass and the true mass. So you see that when you have magnification larger than one, then you will infer a mass that is larger than the true mass. And also you will think that the source is coming from a lower redshift. And then it will be the opposite in the demagnification regime. So this plot is just a zoom up version of this plot at a low redshift. So take this GW150914, for example. Suppose it's not actually 30 solar masses, but only 15 solar masses, a factor of two difference in the mass, then it is still possible if this event is at redshift 1.2 and is being magnified by a factor of 300. Of course, for this particular event, this is very, very unlikely, this magnification factor. But when you start to detect sources from higher, a little bit higher redshift, then you don't need magnification factor on the order of few hundreds. You only need magnification like 10 or 20, and those numbers are more realistic. So it tells you that you can confuse yourself if it's really a binary merger of low mass scale coming from relatively high redshift. But then if it's being magnified, you would think that it's a very massive merger event and coming from relatively low redshift. There's a number of factors that exacerbates this confusion. The first thing is basically you, without a knowledge of magnification, you would like to count how many events you get as a function of the observed mass and observed redshift, because those are the things you can directly fit from the waveform. It will be a convolution of the Lensing PDF, and then of the intrinsic distribution. So in this case, the intrinsic distribution will be some intrinsic rate density, which will be given by astrophysics models, multiplied by some effective volume. So here, I just plot the effective volume as a function of redshift. You see that when you are probing below redshift 2, like redshift 1-ish, the effective volume increases quickly. So that means if you can extend your redshift reach, there's a big reward because the volume increases. Note that this is not very useful when you go beyond a redshift 2, because there isn't that much volume beyond that. And also, when you go to high redshift, there's a dilation factor 1 plus z on the event rate. So this is the first reason that if you are highly magnified and therefore extend your redshift reach from something less than one to something one or two-ish, you get a big boost from the volume. And the second thing is about the intrinsic behavior of the binary of the binary merger rate. So far we don't really have an idea how these massive black hole binaries come into being. There are a range of possibilities proposed by people. Perhaps the most natural one is that they are just formed from binaries of very massive stars. After both stars die, if the binary system is not disrupted, you can get a massive black hole binary. And then the second option is that maybe you get single massive stars, and then they sink into the center of globular clusters and dynamically form pairs. And then after these stars die, they will form massive black hole binaries. It is also possible that that you have pop three stars in the high redshift universe. They tend to be very massive on average. And then after they die, they can give you massive black holes. And if you have, at the very beginning, you have a fraction of binary pop three stars, you can end up with binary black holes. And finally, there can be some more exotic options, such as you might have a primordial black hole population from the very early universe in the radiation-dominated epoch. And then at later time during structure formation, these black holes can dynamically form pairs and give you signatures. So, yes?
The only measure that we have black hole masses is through the electromagnetic, using it from the X-ray binaries. Maximum mass for many of them is about 10 solar. There's 1 in 15 in this population. So at present, the observational evidence does not agree with 3629 for the two present black holes.
Yes. Sorry.
So the question is, if the gravitational waves are coming to this from the source, it's going through a galaxy or something, would that be effective too, maybe? That's what you inferred.
You're saying being gravitationally lensed by something within our own galaxy, stars, yeah. I think that in principle can happen, but I think it's just that like the chance will be relatively small. So we can estimate a chance. Of course, with this one single event, it's hard to say because that's why I think it's interesting. Once you have a large sample, then you can statistically quantify like how likely this is the true mass, like this is the typical mass of this system, or it's some special event that is lensed.
How many events do you
need? I will show some slides. So I don't know how many events we will eventually get, but we can at least assuming some rate and then see how important this is. So just following up the last slide. So the point is that in this prediction of binary evolution, you typically have a mass distribution of these mergers that drops very quickly toward high masses, and you also see that when you go to lower and lower redshift, the high mass tail is more and more suppressed. And this is, roughly speaking, due to the fact that in the low redshift universe, the metallicity is high. So you are more able to cool when you form these stars, and then you don't easily get very massive stars. So this is just the general feature of these models. And also, this is a plot of the total rate you integrate over all masses as a function of redshift. So it also tend to rise a little bit toward redshift 2 or 3-ish, because to some extent, the rate will track the star formation rate, which will be higher at higher redshift. So these two are the factors that will actually boost the intrinsic rate. You expect that the intrinsic rate will be boosted when you go to slightly higher redshift. And also you expect that it's more likely to have massive black holes. And then if a small fraction of them are gravitationally strongly lensed, you will think that you get even higher masses coming from lower redshift. So that introduces a bias when you study the distribution of sources as a function of mass and redshift. So here I'm plotting, so I'm considering a possible scenario from just usual pop 1, pop 2 stars. So here I plot the rate as the rate distribution as a function of mass at each source redshift. So the overall number will be normalized to one of the population synthesis code as shown in previous slide. But then we model this mass distribution using a Schechter function, but to capture the feature that when you go to high redshift, you can produce more massive black holes, but then when you go to low redshift, it's suppressed. So it's not the same as those output from population synthesis code, but it's roughly tracking the general behavior. So then here it is. This plot is without lensing, and this is considered the effect of lensing. Then you find that this corner at very high mass and then redshift 1H, the number count can be boosted due to lensing effect. So here in this plot, I'm plotting the ratio between the number with lensing and the number without lensing. So you see here that at this corner, this ratio can be very high. That means normally you don't expect to see anything from this region, but because of this gravitational lensing effect, you might expect a few events from these beams, and they will appear quite massive. So here, I'm plotting the rate, the cumulative rate above a certain mass, and then integrated over all possible source redshift. So again, I consider different sensitivity curves, current, LIGO, design LIGO, ultimate LIGO, and Einstein telescope. So for Einstein telescope, lensing is not important, because it is so powerful that without lensing, it can already detect most of the events. But for LIGO, this lensing effect can be interesting, because if you compare the curve with lensing and the curve without lensing, you see that when you go to high redshift, lens introduces a power law like tail, an additional tail. So that means when you look at high mass beams, you might see a couple of these events, but then it will not be predicted by your favorite model. You don't expect these massive events happening there. So therefore, if you want to use this kind of statistics to constrain your formation model, you have to account for this lensing this lensing bias effect. You want to undo the convolution with the lensing probability.
So this M is the mass of each black hole, not the total.
Yeah, this is each black hole.
Can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter for Einstein telescope, and that's just because you see plenty of unlensed sources?
Yeah, so it doesn't matter.
You need to boost a really small tail to see something.
Yeah, so it doesn't matter in the sense that, Einstein telescope will surely have more lensed events than these LIGO detectors, but the thing is the relative fraction of lensed events will remain low because even these events are unlensed, unmagnified, the telescope is already powerful enough to see all of them.
Once you get above 100 solar masses and it's up at redshift 1 or 2, does it fall out
of
the lower frequency band?
So when we plot these sensitivity curves, we do account for that. So as I showed many slides before, this sensitivity curve. So you see that, like, if you go to relatively high redshift, this curve actually turns down because the frequency is redshifted, so part of the waveform will go out of band, and then you cannot see it, so that reduces to signal to noise.
And I guess there must be a sharp cutoff at some point, though. That's off. That's at several hundred solar masses.
You still say that lower. Oh, I see what you're saying.
I'm just saying it never emits. Once you get up to a certain mass range, it never emits. Frequencies high enough for LIGO to see.
So at least up to, let's say, 200, a few hundred solar masses, it's not a sharp cutoff because you still have this ring down part that has a frequency equal to the one over the Schwarzschild crossing time. So that is still within the low frequency reach of the detector. So you will miss completely the in spiral phase, but the ring down phase, you can still pick up a few signal to noise. So it's not, I think at least.
It must be, I think it's a few hundred solar masses maybe that even the ring down.
But up to this point, it just decreases slightly. It's not a sharp cutoff. So I think the take home message is that if in the future you want to study the formation mechanism by examining the source population distribution as a function of mass or redshift, you should not be fooled by this magnification bias effect.
But this is only from about 50 solar masses, magnification is a big effect.
For 50.
You expect only about 50.
Yeah, the high. So the low mass end will not.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so, sorry, one way to do this would be, the majority are going to be galaxy lenses, not cluster lenses. So
yes.
If you could just, if you ever localize the position of the gravitational wave source with any accuracy, you could look for the presence of massive galaxies to remove the magnification factor.
Yeah, I think that is very important. That is something we haven't studied, but that's a very important thing to study because so here the assumption is that it's really hard to figure out whether or not it is being lensed or not. So you can only study this in using the statistical approach. But if you can actually figure out which events are gravitationally lensed by resorting to sky localization information, then that would be great because then in that case you don't have this degeneracy. You just you will be able to measure the magnification directly and then the intrinsic parameter of the system.
Of actually resolving the lens image?
That requires very high angular resolution. So for example, for galaxy lens, the angular separation will be on the order of arc second. So a few arc seconds. So I think I think with gravitational wave observation, that's a bit hard to do that.
But you would see multiple images.
In the time, in the time domain, you see
time,
like yeah,
yeah,
yeah. That's
that
true.
Would be very.
So another possible thing is to, if you expect two events coming from the same source and then separated by a long time, but if you can do cross correlation, you might still be able to identify that these have the same waveform up to a overall.
I was going to ask about the same thing. So have you looked into that whether you could actually figure out which ones are magnified and which ones
yes,
are not?
Yes.
Have you looked into that?
Not yet. But this is something different from this one. But yes, I think it's even more interesting if you can figure out these events. So I just quickly add a few points. So if we have But say if the formation model predicts that we will have a prolonged tail of high mass events, so that the high mass tail doesn't decay very quickly, it decays in a power law, then this will be hard because even at high masses, the length diffraction will still remain small. So that will not be an important effect. So it varies from model to model. And again, this is the point the audience raised. So if multiple images can be identified, then the strong lensing statistics can be directly measured. You measure the PDF because you know the magnification. And then, but I think here the challenge is that the time delay is long. So the first step is to be able to identify two events that are possibly coming from the same source.
So but even in that case, you only measure the relative magnification of the two. I mean, you don't know the position, so we'll still maybe not be so easy. You know the time delay and the relative magnification.
No, in this case, because you, in this case, I think, in this case, you will have flux the ratio between the two images, and then you will have more information, but then that depends on the lens parameter. So right.
But you can't resolve where it is relative to the lens, so you have very limited information. And you won't locate gravity wave sources unless you have a counterpart.
Yeah.
And the counterpart is lens, and then everything is fine.
Yeah, if you have a counterpart.
You might see multiple images of the counterpart.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's true. So you have more information, but still there's some level of uncertainty.
So that picture you showed of the lens supernova, how does that work if there's such a long time delay?
Or the galaxy.
Oh, because the time delay it varies. Like the typical is like weeks to months, but sometimes it can be shorter. And also supernova shines for a period of time. It doesn't shine like for 1 minute. It shines for a few days, months. So And also, if you are like right behind the lens, then the time delay, because it's more symmetric, so the time delay will be shorter.
I think there's only one lens supernova.
There are two.
Okay.
But not many.
Counting your lens or images?
But it's just, yes, that's a good point. Yes.
Okay, so it turns out that I don't have much time for the second part. I will go through it briefly, quickly. So this is about constraining compact dark matter scenarios using FRBs, the faster radio bursts. So this is a collaboration with the with people at Johns Hopkins University, including my PhD advisor. So FRBs are a very interesting phenomenon. They are very swift bursts in radio waves. So for example, if you monitor in a time domain at certain frequencies, sometimes you see a very short pulse. And then you don't know what's going on. So far, 17 events has been published. Typically, they have a flux density of order 0.1 to 0.5 Jansky. So they're not that dim, but so far no counterpart has been no counterpart at different frequency band has been confirmed for these FRBs. There's a claim one in which an afterglow from a possible host galaxy of the event is found, but that one is still disputable. And then the pulse profile of these events also varies. Some do show very mysterious, intriguing repetitions, such as this one. So it is unclear whether or not this is due to the intrinsic property of the source, or this is due to some scattering effects when the radio wave comes from the source to the Earth. But still, generally speaking, these can serve as good sources for strong lensing. The first thing is that because the time scale is very, very short, it suggests that whatever causes the burst, it has to be some very compact source. So it's effectively a point source and is subject to very high magnification. The second thing is that from the dispersion measure of these events, which means that you check the time of arrival of the burst as a function of frequency, and then you see a dependence on the frequency that scale as 1 over frequency square. And this is due to propagation through interstellar or intergalactic medium. But then, but then the implication is that it is very likely that these events come from cosmological distances. When they come from far away, there will be a larger chance that they can be gravitationally lensed. And finally, although we only have detected 17 events so far, we might detect a lot more in the future, because if you are able to monitor the whole sky all the time, then you expect something like 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 5 events per sky per day. That is huge. But so far, we are limited by the area of the sky we can monitor simultaneously. But say this Canadian hydrogen intensity mapping experiment, CHIME, a reasonable estimate gives something like 10 to the 4 events per year. So if this comes true, then we will expect to have a much larger sample of FRBs. And then we can study gravitational lensing because a small fraction of them can be subject to very strong magnification. So the simplest thing we can do using lensing of FRBs is to constrain compact dark matter scenario. So this is the idea that dark matter exists in the form of quite a dense lumps. So you can have things like black hole dark matter, or you can have less compact dark matter, such as some nuclear matter. But the point is that as long as it's sufficiently compact, it can be a very efficient lens. So here, you can plot the constraint on the possible fraction of such compact dark matter as a function of the mass of the clump. So there have been a lot of observations that constrain certain mass regions. For example, you can use micro lensing to constrain masses on the order of one solar mass or below. And then by studying how likely wide binaries can be disrupted by these massive clumps, you can constrain the higher mass region, like above 1,000 solar masses. But then there remains a very interesting window between 10 solar masses and 100 solar masses that is actually not ruled out by both observations.
Are you ignoring those blue lines for some reason?
But then you notice that these blue lines seems to like cover out this window. So these blue lines are actually, first of all, these blue lines apply to the scenario of black hole dark matter. If you do have black holes in the early universe, black holes will accrete matter and then give X-rays. These X-rays will heat the plasma and create CMB anisotropies, temperature anisotropies, and spectrum distortions. So there was a work assuming a stationary Bondi accretion model and then estimate how much energy will be given out by black hole accretion. So this seems to be pretty strong. But the first comment is that it is unclear whether or not the Bondi accretion solution is actually realized in nature, because it's a highly symmetric, assuming no relative velocity, and highly fine-tuned solution. So if you have something else, such as a disk accretion disk, then it is a little bit unclear how this bound can be mitigated. And the second thing is that if dark matter is not made of black holes, it will not accrete and convert gravitational energy into X-rays. So then this bound will not apply. So given these uncertainties, I think, and also given the prospect of a large sample of FRBs, it is still interesting to constrain this window using this simple physics of strong gravitational lensing, because that thing is fairly simple and we understand it better. So the idea is you want to detect the time delay of these two images due to intervening compact dark matter. And then this time you require that the time delay cannot be too short, because then you will not be able to resolve the two and tell that it has been lensed. It cannot be too large, because then one of the image will be very dim, so it will be below the detection threshold. So that allows you to compute the cross-section from each such dark matter clump. And then given the total dark matter mass in the universe, you multiply by the number of such clumps to get an optical depth. So here, I'm plotting the optical depth as a function of source redshift. So you see that when mass is small, the optical depth is relatively small, because the time delay is typically short, and a lot of times you are not able to resolve the two peaks. It will be below 1 millisecond separation. But when the mass is like 50 and beyond, the time delay is sufficiently long, you can resolve it. So given that the total mass is conserved, it will saturate to some high mass limit for the optical depths. And then you see that the lens diffraction will be pretty significant if order one dark matter exists in the form of such compact clump. It will be on the order of few percent. So I will skip this, because this is just about a different possibilities of the redshift distribution of the sources when we do the detailed calculation. But the result is that you can observe a time delay and a flux ratio, and they are correlated. So the time delay will be on the order of milliseconds that is possible for you to resolve with current FRB observations. And then the flux ratio should not be too large, because otherwise the second image will be too dim. But this type of distribution allows you to, in case you detect a handful of double peak structure, you still wonder whether or not it can be due to some intrinsic source property, or it's a gravitationally lensed event. Then you want to compare to this time delay flux ratio distribution to see if it agrees with your expectation. Also you want to check the pulse profile of different components, because if it's really due to gravitational lensing, you expect to have the same pulse profile at every frequency. But if it's intrinsic behavior, then you don't expect that.
One comment here is that if you want to distinguish.
Yes, I should say that. But if you wonder whether or not this 5 millisecond time delay for FRB 12102 is due to lensing, if you assume a point lens, this somehow corresponds to a little bit large, a mass that is a little bit large, larger than 200 solar masses, and then the most probable value is like 500 or 1,000 solar masses. So that is a little bit big because it's not clear that we have such an abundance of intermediate mass black holes in the universe. So the reason this mass turns out to be large is because these two peaks, you see that they almost have the same strength. So that suggests a flux ratio close to one. And also a detailed fitting of this pulse shape suggests that the second component is actually a little bit brighter than the first one. And that is also not explained by the by lensing due to a point lens, because in that case, the first peak is always brighter than the second peak. So that is why this particular event, there are parameters that can explain it, but that parameter is not a very not very likely to happen. It requires very fine alignment and then very massive lenses.
If you weren't sure whether you saw an intrinsic double peak or a gravitational lens in play, then usually when we record these events, we keep the high speed electric field data, not just the square and sample flow out. And then it's easy to tell whether you have the same actual realization of the electric field in the 2 weeks or not.
Yes, yeah.
Probably the,
but it's noise dominated, isn't it?
Well, it's detected with signal noise, but you can cross correlate to get the same signal noise.
You think that's just phase gives you one additional information?
Yeah. I mean, cross-correlating the actual realizations of the electric field have about the same signal noise as the actual detection.
So I guess I had the related question. I mean, in principle, if it's lensing, you should see the same thing at different frequencies?
Yes.
And do you?
So this one, I'm sure it is seen at different frequencies because otherwise it would be really weird. But of course, from the published paper, they only show this plot. They don't show this double peak feature at different frequencies.
They have better dispersion measures, so they should have different frequencies, right? So.
Yeah, they should have. They just it's not shown in the paper. I think another thing to check is, say you have this profile, does it vary? How does it vary with frequency?
Yeah.
But from the published paper, there isn't available information for us to answer that question. But I'm sure the experiment group, they have the data. So then, if you finally work out what the constraint is, let's assume you, in using 1 year's observation, you detect 10 to the 4 FRBs. And then you constrain what fraction of dark matter can be in the form of compact clumps of certain masses. Then you see that previously you have this window. And now, depending on what is the minimum time delay, the minimum time delay you can resolve, you have different constraints, but they all converge at the high mass end because it will not matter there. Here it matters, but if you have 1 millisecond ability to, you can resolve 1 millisecond time delay, you can tightly constrain this part. So if you do have some fraction, like a few percent fraction that are in the form of compact lumps, then you expect to see at least like one such event in the survey.
How much does the assumed distribution of the FRBs matter? Does it matter? Like, is it crucial that they be at cosmological distances?
Or? So it actually matters a lot. So here, the plot that I show is conservative in the sense that we are just assume that the distribution of FRB is some distribution that seems to fit the already available 17 events catalog. But then we multiply by the number of events, which is assumed to be 10 to the 4, and then multiply by the optical depth. But this calculation, strictly speaking, is not correct because you can have events that are at high redshift that that are not detectable without lensing, but if it's strongly magnified, it will come above your detection threshold. So in that sense, this incorrect calculation is like a conservative, gives you a conservative answer. So if you model that more carefully, you can benefit from this magnification bias, and then the constraint will become a little bit better. But
can I ask it another way? So I've heard some people give arguments that these things are likely not from cosmological distances. That there's this fact that the rotation measure, if it was due to the interstellar medium, it's coming from cosmological distance. But I've heard people say that in some fraction of the events, you see an exponential tail after the event that would be due to that would be interpretable as some turbulence in the medium that was doing the dispersion measure but it's not consistent with what you could get for turbulence in the intergalactic medium. I meant to say sorry. That must be coming from close to a compact object or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So I know these results, but personally, because I don't understand that subject very well, so I think personally I am not able to provide an answer.
But some people say it's possible. I heard another thing, which I guess is not. I at one point heard a rumor, but although apparently no paper has appeared yet, so I don't know what happened to it. But I heard a rumor that there was one FRB that was detected where you saw saw periodic follow-ups, like you saw 10 of them with like 8-second period, which kind of suggested it was some kind of some kind of neutron star. So my basic question is, if it does turn out, I guess we don't know, but if it does turn out that they're all really coming from not our galaxy, but
local, yes.
Not within the nearest 10 megaparsecs or something, or maybe 100 megaparsecs, do you still see what effect would that have if they're all basically pretty quasi-local?
Then it depends on how local it is. So the optical depth will decrease simply because the volume you traverse is smaller and smaller. But then the magnification bias might increase a bit because. I think the final number will weaken. If it's truly local.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I wonder if it would still be, I guess if the key thing is to rule out that window of the 30 solar mass black hole, I wonder if it would be still strong enough or not. I'm kind of curious to know.
Yes.
The repeating FRB paper is published.
What?
The repeating FRB paper is published.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yes. It's repeating, but it's repeating in a very weird manner. It's not like periodically repeating.
Not periodic. Okay.
So I think if in a good case these do come from redshift 1-ish, then the forthcoming FRB surveys are expected to provide a very good sample to study strong gravitational lensing and constrain compact dark matter of masses between 10 to 100 solar masses. So in principle, there are other lenses that can produce multiple peaks from in the FRB observation, but those lenses tend to give very small optical depths. So those are like the more conventional lenses, such as dark matter halos in the universe, and they create the right time delay, so the time delay is not big. You were easily able to identify a multi-peaked structure, but then the optical depth is fairly low. So it is, at this point, it is unclear whether or not FRB has the potential to do that. I think the major answer we want to figure out is whether or not FRBs are truly at cosmological distances or not. Okay, so I think I will stop here. Thank you. Yeah. Yes.
So I think it's related to your last point. I mean, I guess you took the, you assume the uniform universe are basically dark matter made up of these matches.
Yeah, in our calculation, it's.
But in reality, these matches would be in dark matter halo.
Yes.
But just trying to, I think maybe it doesn't matter so much as long as you're in this limit where you're looking for rare events. But if they're not rare, then,
yes.
then it's not interesting. I mean, you're limiting the number of events from below, assuming that they're rare. If they're rare, I guess it doesn't really matter if the match or the lens is in a halo or not. And it would be in a halo. All the dark matter would be in halos. So it would change the difference, but it would change the probability of having multiple events. But if you're looking at the low probability limit where you only have one event anyway, I think it doesn't matter if it's two in halos or because the halo, because you know the optical depth for lensing, even from galaxies, is not so high. But if you look at dark matter halos, the optical depth is greater than one up to high register. So
right.
you're always almost always covered by a halo along the time cycle. So I think it doesn't matter too much.
Yeah, in terms of the total optical depth, it will, like if you carefully modeling how clustered the dark matter is, it will, the answer will change, but it will not change significantly. But in terms of the signature topology, it can make a difference because if you are lensed by a macho, let's say in a big galactic halo, then in principle, you cannot do this calculation assuming an isolated lens. You would need to put this lens in the external shear produced by the galaxy. And in that case, you break the azimuthal symmetry of the problem. And in this case, you can actually generate four peaks instead of two peaks. So, yeah, so in that case, you do expect some special signature that you might see. But in terms of the total optical depth, I think it's a small correction. It's not like completely changing the order of magnitude.
So I had a question about the accretion into the black holes in the primordial universe that seem to be set in very strong bounds.
Yes.
You said that there is a very simplistic picture and so on. Why not working out the proper constraints with the, I mean, it's the redshifts that are relevant. 600 or 800, it's still fairly simple universe, right? And even if you have a Christian disk, you would still have probably a lot of UV light coming out of this that would be harmful. I mean, ionized hydrogen and so on. So either way, there must be some sort of constraints.
Yeah, I'm also wondering about this question.
No, but you said black holes, do they need to assume that there is compact black hole? And if they're not compact, then it's not a problem?
No, you need to be black holes because if you are just some compact, let's say, if you're just some compact stuff, then you do accrete them, but you don't convert a lot of gravitational energy into
right.
pure radiation. So in that case, you don't expect
right.
sufficient heating.
So general matches are not, they're
yeah.
not necessarily black
yeah.
holes.
But
don't have that limit.
Yes, I think so. But for black, yeah, and for black hole, you will need to worry about this accretion. But I think, so far, there hasn't been, for example, some numerical simulation of the accretion process. Like,
those are very similar to the disks that we do have around X-ray binaries. So because I mean, there are, as like as John mentioned, there are 10-solar mass black holes in our galaxy, and you observe, and we know their properties rather well. So, I mean, you expect similar properties from those guys,
and the interstellar medium is simpler.
But I mean, I think the difference is maybe the densities of the medium, but I don't think that changes the fundamentals very much. So, interstellar medium and then early universe, they have slightly different content, slightly different density.
Yeah.
But the disks themselves don't care too much about the environment.
Simeon Bird was here several weeks ago giving a talk about that Did LIGO Detect Dark Matter paper, and he mentioned in their talk that they thought there was something to beyond just that simplification, they mentioned that there was something maybe that they disagreed with in the Riccati calculation, something that might actually parametrically change the answer, not just by order one, so that they were redoing the calculation or something. So I don't know. I think that at least at the time that he gave the talk, they were working on paper and thought it might be too strong, significantly too strong.
Well, I mean, I have to work out the numbers, but I think the zeroth order estimate is if you have a bunch of 100 solar mass black holes sitting in an ambient gas medium, you're going to get almost quasi-continuous accretion for a long period of time. And that will increase the optical depth to the CMB, and your tau limits will be violated by quite a bit. And we already know that tau is from Planck is relatively low, so you can't have that as being. So if it is a significant process, then it has to be very stochastic, occurring for very brief periods of time. And there is no reason why that would be the case, because this gas is still sitting around and the black holes are still sitting around. So I think that's the best argument against there being a large population of these in the ambient gas density.
So that is from late time accretion, during the recent universe, or?
No, I think it could be anything like that. It should be 600 to 500.
Yeah. Oh, but after recombination.
After recombination.
Because those constraints, this spectral distortion constraint is dominated, according to their calculation, is dominated by pre-recombination epoch.
But the Dapilimab one was a stronger constraint, the Dapilimab. And I'm guessing that should come from after the Dapilimab constraint.
The Dapilimab. That constraint is the WMAP constraint, I think, is dominated by the post recombination epoch.
Sorry,
600.
They said 600. Yeah. Getting back to the models, evolutionary models that we've studied over the years. It's able to calculate the electricity changes from the weight the mass loss. And also, thanks for models of supernova exposure. All favor the total binary, total binary mass of about 20 or so.
Not higher, but not higher. So I think in that case, then you're basically saying let's say if the intrinsic, if on this plot, you only have black holes binaries here, and then you'd have nothing here.
Right.
In this case, you still, after you convolve with the lensed PDF, you still expect some tail here. So those are not truly massive events. They're just you think it is massive because you confuse yourself.
So maybe there are primordial 100 solar mass black hole, but then you have to justify this.
Maybe could I just ask one question about I was interested in the first part of the talk, this business about that lensing of gravitational waves by stars is in the refractive regime. So is that so in such an event, so if a LIGO source is lensed that way, you'll see, I guess, the waveform will be quite modified relative to the predicted waveform will be
quite modified relative
to the traditional prediction.
Yes,
and
because
it sounds like you would have sounds like there might be the parameter space for the waveform would have, you know, several different additional parameters, you know, the mass of the lens and the impact parameter and stuff like that. That sounds interesting. You mentioned there was another paper about this. Do you know the probability that sort of lensing happens occurs for LIGO?
There are not a lot of papers. There are a few papers, and that was one paper was written like around 2004, and at that time people thought LISA is going to fly in 2011. So they focus on like gravitational waves produced by, let's say, a smaller black hole orbiting a big black hole, and then you're in the Lisa band, and then you can, and then you're lensed by, let's say, a supermassive black hole or a galaxy, and then they're considering that regime instead of the LIGO regime. For LIGO, there isn't a lot of papers on that.
LIGO should be, when they're doing their template fitting, should they be including?
Yeah. So if you have if you're in a diffractive regime, then the amplitude, so in the geometrical regime, the magnification is independent of frequency. But in the diffractive regime, the amplitude increase will be dependent on the frequency, and it depends on not just a monotonic way, but on a like complicated, like oscillatory way, and also there will be a phase shift. So in that case, after you apply this frequency dependent response to the original waveform, you get a different waveform that is distorted.
But the number of events is tiny. I mean, if you show the plot of the number, not this one, but I think it's the next slide where it's this one, right? Like,
I thought this was just for the number due to galactic cleansing.
Yes.
So for design LIGO, you don't see any events that where the lensing matters. As far as I can tell,
due to galactic lenses.
It's a few here, and then for this, is you see some.
Isn't the idea though that these curves have not included lensing by stars?
These are not, because these are computed using some PDF. It's not exactly this PDF, because this PDF is measured through n-body simulation of large scale structure. But that doesn't include baryonic matter, but we know that baryonic matter is very important for the strong lensing tail. So if you add baryonic matter, this tail will be boosted by a factor few. And then we use some analytical fit, but we do not include like stellar-sized lenses.
So the stellar microlensing would happen only if the baryonic wave passes through a galaxy, in which case it would be strongly magnified already.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it won't be micro.
Well, in fact, so if you estimate the number of stars, if it's already strongly lensed by a galaxy, and therefore at least one image will pass through the galaxy pretty close to the center, then you estimate what's the chance that it will, in addition, pass near a star. Actually, that chance is very high. It's order one chance. But the only thing we worry is like, it's in the diffractive regime, so we don't expect to have a very significant impact.
But
the chance is actually very high, because there are so many stars in the galaxy that are densely populated.
All right, let's take one more time.